I want to open today's show by reading an article written by my son, Sean Foley. Sean is a professor of history who specializes in the Middle East. The article is called Winning Their Hearts, Minds, and Prayers. Lost in the news coverage in recent weeks about the ailing U.S. economy and the Democratic presidential nomination has been an issue that may define the future security of the United States, how the Muslim world views America. Among analysts and political figures in both parties, there is agreement that the Bush administration's attempts to improve the standing of America in the Muslim world through soft power or cultural diplomacy have failed. As we search for ways to improve America's relationship with Muslims, we would do well to recall the most successful example of U.S. cultural diplomacy in the Muslim world, the Hajj airlift in 1952, when the U.S. Air Force flew nearly 4,000 Muslims from Lebanon to Saudi Arabia for the pilgrimage Hajj to Mecca. Virtually unknown today, the airlift for Allah was not the result of a U.S. policy or official initiative specifically meant to engage Muslims. Instead, it reflected the creative response of Lebanese, Saudi, and U.S. officials to a humanitarian crisis. During the summer of 1952, thousands of Muslims flocked to Beirut, hoping to take advantage of a reduction in the Hajj pilgrimage fees and direct air service to Jeddah, the gateway to Mecca. As Air Liban and other airlines became overwhelmed, and it appeared that thousands would miss the Hajj, Lebanese officials sought an unorthodox solution: U.S. military assistance. The U.S. ambassador, Harold Miner, readily agreed to the idea and sent a telegram to Washington recommending as a goodwill gesture that the U.S. Air Force fly pilgrims to Saudi Arabia. An affirmative response came immediately from Washington, and 13 U.S. C-54 military transport planes soon arrived in Beirut. Grateful Muslims shouted, "Praise Allah! Praise America!" as they left Beirut for Jeddah. Over the next 4 days, a C-54 took off every hour from Beirut, and each pilgrim with a ticket for Jeddah arrived before the Hajj started. Saudi officials also did their part. They extended the Hajj deadline several days to facilitate the airlift. Upon reaching Saudi Arabia, a Turkish pilgrim cabled his nation's prime minister and president, "At no time in history has so much help been offered from so far away and for such a large number of people in such a noble cause. Muslims will not forget this gesture." A leading Lebanese Muslim religious figure publicly proclaimed that Muslims must include Americans, infidels though they are, in their prayers. After the airlift, State Department officials discussed using the proceeds from the unused tickets sold to the airlines, approximately $260,000, to fund Muslim cultural exchanges and a center for pilgrims in Jeddah or Beirut, the House of American Hospitality. Unfortunately, none of these ideas were adopted. Washington found that it was easier and more politically expedient to donate the $260,000 to the Lebanese Muslim Welfare Committee. In June 1953, the State Department sent a telegram to U.S. posts throughout the Muslim world stating that under no circumstances would Washington be involved in a Hajj airlift again. By the late 1950s, the Hajj airlift had completely disappeared from public consciousness and ceased being a tool of public diplomacy. The Hajj airlift provides us with two lessons for public diplomacy and the Muslim world. First, if we retain flexible conceptions of public diplomacy and take advantage of opportunities quickly, we can achieve significant diplomatic successes. Second, if we do not follow up on future public diplomacy successes, they may disappear from public consciousness and be of little value to us as a tool of statecraft. Forgotten or not, Airlift for Allah was one of our few genuinely creative exchanges with the Muslim world. That was an article written by my son, Sean Foley, who is a professor of history and a specialist in the Middle East. The rest of the show will be portions from a program originally broadcast and written in 1991. It was called Ground War Like Ground Meat, and it was about quite a different, but not that different, Bush administration. We dealt in that program with war and peace, invasion and poetry. The show featured my wife Adele along with me. We'll begin with a poem by the painter Marsden Hartley. It's called V is for Victory, as you can plainly see. And it was published posthumously in Hartley's Selected Poems in 1945. Hartley died in 1943.
I never really liked this cat, though she is a valuable asset to this household. Everybody smiles and is pleased when she rolls over on a mouse, and if she gets a rat by the back of the neck, she drags him in until somebody has noticed her skill, and then she will chew off his head.
She does far worse than this. She catches birds, and it makes no difference how the family frowns. She pays no attention to it. She has just caught a little bird and killed a song. It flutters a little in her tightened jaws. I try to get it loose, but suddenly I see the head lean back, give up the ghost. In each of the cat's eyes is a vast V.
In each of the cat's eyes is a vast V.
No more songs now in the waving grass. A friend of mine writes me, now that the war is over, we can start living again. We can continue to write about life. We live, no doubt, in difficult times. Almost everyone I know feels depressed, lonely, alienated, with a sense of, am I the only one? Was the war in the Persian Gulf really so widely supported?
President George Bush has been propagating a second-rate mythology which doesn't mention its own murderous consequences.
How is it possible to respond?
Can we respond? Are the dead glad to have been slaughtered so that America can exorcise its Vietnam trauma?
Why isn't America traumatized by the events in the Persian Gulf?
Where others feel release, the people I know feel only frustration, or frustration mixed with anger, bewilderment.
Do we really live here?
Does our opinion matter at all?
What does it mean to be American? The mood of the country.
But is it the mood of the country?
Is a mirror in which we are sickened to see ourselves.
How is love? How is any connection possible here?
Is it possible to love some people while we are murdering others?
The Persian Gulf issue has a physical dimension.
To admire what we did there requires an act of repression, of denial, of misnaming.
Such acts extend deeply into our history. It is precisely how we handled the Indians.
A friend phoned me recently and said the word genocide.
Is it possible to feel national pride without murdering someone?
Oughtn't we to feel national pride because we have not murdered someone?
How are we roused to thought?
How are we roused to speech? Earlier today, I met a very nice six-year-old named Sam. He had just finished making a paper airplane. He didn't bother trying to fly it. He just pointed it at me and said, "Bang."
How can we love one another when everything we pick up is a gun? A phallus is not a gun, but a possible bridge, a possible connector.
Love is not something we do to someone. It is something we do with someone, for someone. Sam was trying to make a connection with me. He wanted to be a hit in my consciousness. Bang! He would have been appalled had his gun turned out to be real. Had I exploded there in front of him? Someone asked me years ago, did you bang her? No, but I wanted to.
Pleasure is violence in a repressive, guilt-ridden culture. Violence and sexuality go together.
Bang!
When we are faced with some enormous blockage to which violence seems the only adequate response.
How do we learn to love one another? Bang!
How do we learn to speak?
Ground war, like ground meat. I was asked to make some comments on the effects of censorship on a radio station like KPFA. I said that I thought the war itself was a mode of censorship. War coverage tends to dominate any radio station at a time like that. It becomes the story, the news.
But it seems to me that insofar as we allow the war to dominate our consciousness, then the war has won. Part of the point of this war in the Persian Gulf was to deflect our awareness from anything else. If we allow that to happen, even in our opposition to the war, then we are the war.
I was born in 1940.
World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf.
It is necessary to keep, even as we take up an oppositional stance, the sense of what that opposition is rooted in.
What does it mean to be alive?
What does it mean to have a body?
What does it mean to experience pleasure and delight?
Ground war, like ground meat. The following passage is taken from Ezra Pound's poem, You, Selwyn Morberly, published in 1921. It deals with the First World War, called the Great War at the time. Pound quotes a bit of Greek from Pindar, which is immediately translated.
The Latin is from the Roman poet Horace. Dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. Sweet and fitting it is to die for your country. You will see that Pound is by no means in agreement with that sentiment.
O bright Apollo, ten anthra, ten eroa, ten atheon.
What god, man, or hero shall I place a tin wreath upon?
These fought in any case.
And some believing.
Pro domo in any case.
Some quick to arm.
Some for adventure.
Some from fear of weakness.
Some from fear of censure.
Some for love of slaughter, in imagination, learning later.
Some in fear, learning love of slaughter. Died some. Pro patria, non dulce, non et decor, walked I deep in hell.
Believing in old men's lies, then unbelieving.
Came home, home to a lie.
Home to many deceits.
Home to old lies and new infamy.
Usury, age old and age thick.
And liars in public places. Daring as never before. Wastage as never before. Young blood and high blood. Fair cheeks and fine bodies.
Fortitude as never before.
Frankness as never before. Disillusions as never told in the old days. Hysterias.
Trench confessions.
Laughter out of dead bellies.
There died a myriad, and of the best among them, for an old bitch gone in the teeth for a botched civilization.
Charm, smiling at the good mouth. Quick eyes gone under earth's lid.
For too gross of broken statues, for a few thousand battered books.
Pound had much earlier published a poem which is very different in its sense of war from what we have just heard. It's a sestina, which is a complicated form. You'll find the last words of each stanza repeating as the poem goes along, and there's a certain tension between the poem's passionate speech and its extremely refined form. The repeated words are peace, music, clash, opposing, crimson, rejoicing. The speaker is Bertrand de Born, a warrior and a troubadour of 12th century Provence. And as Pound tells us, Dante Alighieri put this man in hell for that he was a stir-up of strife. Ecovi, judge ye, have I dug him up again?
The scene is at Altaforte, Bourne's castle. Papillos is his jongleur, his minstrel, the singer of his songs. The leopard is the device of Richard Coeur de Lion, Richard the Lion-hearted.
Sestina, Altaforte. Damn it all. All this our south stinks. Peace,
You horse and dog papules, come. Let's to music. I have no life save when the swords clash. But ah, when I see the standards gold, ver, purple opposing, and the broad fields beneath them turn crimson, then howl I my heart nigh mad with rejoicing. In hot summer have I great rejoicing, when the tempests kill the earth's foul peace, and the lightnings from black heaven flash crimson, and the fierce thunders roar me their music, and the winds shriek through the clouds mad, opposing, and through all the riven skies God's swords clash. Hell grant soon we hear again the swords clash, and the shrill neighs of destriers in battle rejoicing, spiked breast to spiked breast opposing. Better 1 hour's stewer than a year's peace, with fat boards, bawds, wine, and frail music. Bah! There's no wine like the blood's crimson. And I love to see the sun rise, blood crimson, and I watch his spears through the dark clash, and it fills all my heart with rejoicing, and pries wide my mouth with fast music, when I see him so scorn and defy peace, his lone might against all darkness opposing. The man who fears wars and squats opposing my words for stewer hath no blood of crimson, but is fit only to rot in womanish peace, far from where worth's won and the swords clash. For the death of such sluts I go rejoicing. Yea, I fill all the air with my music. Papules, papules to the music. There's no sound like to swords, swords opposing. No cry like the battles rejoicing. When our elbows and swords drip the crimson, and our charges against the leopards rush clash. May God damn forever all who cry peace. And let the music of the swords make them crimson. Hell grant soon we hear again the swords clash. Hell blot black for alway the thought peace.
May God damn forever all who cry peace. Pound had a very different understanding of war when he wrote Mauberly.
The war he is talking about here, in this poem, Alta Forte, is at least half metaphorical. It's a war of mental energy, a war of opposing principles. It is not quite a physical war, or at least not entirely a physical war, but it is expressed as a physical war.
The sentiment is something like what drove Pound's friend, the great poet William Butler Yeats, to write late in life and on the eve of World War II.
You that Mitchell's prayer have heard, send war in our time, O Lord. Know that when all words are said, and a man is fighting mad, something drops from eyes long blind. He completes his partial mind.
When Pound experienced the reality of the First World War, he arrived at a very different sense of what war meant. It was no longer a question of war as a metaphor of mental activity. For many of the finest intellects of Pound's generation, war meant precisely the end of mental activity.
Died some.
Pound's experience of World War I determined his life and career to a large degree. The final passages of his long poem, The Cantos, hope for peace in the world.
The scientists are in terror. And the European mind stops.
Wyndham Lewis chose blindness rather than have his mind stop.
Night under wind, mid Garofani, the petals are almost still. Mozart, Linnaeus, Salmona.
When one's friends hate each other, how can there be peace in the world?
Their asperities diverted me in my green time.
A blown husk that is finished,
but the light sings eternal.
And this from the very end of the Cantos.
Do not move. Let the wind speak. That is paradise.
Pound's shifting away from the over-there mentality is a shifting of metaphors. Mental activity does not have to be understood as war. Male sexuality does not have to be understood as war.
Yet it was very difficult for Pound, as it is very difficult for anyone in our culture, to get away from the idea of the warrior as hero. Whether that warrior is, as it was for Pound, Odysseus, Sigismundo Malatesta, or Benito Mussolini. Or as it is for us, John Wayne, Dirty Harry, or Luke Skywalker.
In a military culture, value tends to be expressed in terms of war. That's killer.
War not only structures consciousness, it creates consciousness. Images of war pour forth in situations which in fact have little to do with war. In the Sistina we read a few moments ago, Bertrand de Born's jongleur, his minstrel, stands next to him, admiring him. He sees de Born as, in Pound's phrase, the live man among the duds.
De Born is the physical embodiment of the active intellect. How is it possible to evoke the active intellect without evoking war?
How is it possible to represent the activity of peace?
The great poet of mental energy, William Blake, wrote in the 18th century,
I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. Again, mental activity as war. Pound's lines, do not move, let the wind speak, are beautiful lines, but they are lines about silence. They understand peace not as the generator of speech, but as the ending of speech. In these lines, to be at peace is to listen.
How can we change? What is the basis of our warrior culture?
Where does our desire to make war come from? The crucial defining event for classical Greece was the Trojan War. And since Greece stands at the beginning of what we think of as Western civilization, war stands at the beginning of Western civilization.
Homer's Iliad became the pattern of the truly ambitious poem, the poem with which to transcend the merely personal and to tell the tale of the tribe. Such a poem, again and again in our culture, with a few significant exceptions, has been a long poem about war, an epic, a word which, incidentally, goes back to the Greek word for speech.
When, in the 17th century, John Milton wrote Paradise Lost, his subject, the expulsion of Adam and Eve from Eden, had no obvious connection to war. And so Satan entered the poem as a major character. Milton could then include, though there was very little mention of it in Scripture, the war in heaven.
Even the erotic tradition in the West has something martial about it. Tends towards conjuring up not pleasure, but the war between the sexes, or beyond that, the New Testament's war in the members. This is what passes for a love poem in the Western tradition.
I find no peace, and all my war is done.
I fear and hope. I burn and freeze like ice.
I fly above the wind, yet can I not arise?
And naught I have, and all the world I season.
That looseth nor locketh, holdeth me in prison.
And holdeth me not. Yet can I scape no wise.
Nor letteth me live, nor die at my device.
And yet of death it giveth none occasion.
Without iron I see, and without tongue I plain. I desire to perish, and yet I ask health.
I love another, and thus I hate myself.
I feed me in sorrow, and laugh in all my pain.
Likewise displeaseth me both death and life.
And my delight is causer of this strife.
This is a sonnet by the 16th century English poet Sir Thomas Wyatt. Another of his poems is titled, How the Lover Perisheth in His Delight as the Fly in the Fire. Wyatt's poems are an almost exact equivalent to the biblical passage about the war in the members.
From where come wars and fightings among you, says the Bible? Come they not here, even of your lusts that war in your members?
Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not.
Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lusts. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God?
Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the
enemy
of God.
James 4.
Wyatt's poetry, which took the Italian sonnets of Petrarch as its model, was a brilliant solution to the problem of Western eroticism. The biblical passage just quoted has nothing to do with the sexual love of a woman. It condemns adulterers and adulteresses.
Wyatt's poem has everything to do with the sexual love of a woman, yet it expresses sexual love in terms which unmistakably recall a passage from the Bible which condemns sexual love. Sexual love is thus at once triumphantly expressed and triumphantly denied, the solution of the West.
The poem is a kind of battleground, a field of war, in which desire and guilt are the endlessly vying combatants. There never was a war that was not inward, wrote the American poet Marianne Moore during World War II. I must fight till I have conquered in myself what causes war. Moore's lines are a secularization of the war in the members' passage, and their metaphor for conquering war is war. This is Jack Foley. You've been listening to Ground War Like Ground Meat, a show originally aired on KPFA in 1991. In it, I try to replace the deep image of the warrior in American culture with the deep image of the dancer, who is as active as a warrior, but who doesn't kill anybody.
This is Jack Foley. You heard my son Sean Foley's essay, Winning Their Hearts, Minds, and Prayers, and excerpts from my 1991 radio show, Ground War,
Like Ground Meat. The scheduled show with Daniel P. Cassidy will be heard next week. Be sure to catch Catherine Hastings' Word Temple show on KRCB on the Internet tonight at 7 p.m., her show will feature the late Lynn Lonadier. Listen to Richard Walensky on tomorrow's Cover to Cover. I'll be back in a week with Daniel P. Cassidy. Thank you, Miss M. Happy St. Joseph's Day, and thanks for listening.
Molly Ivan said, if Will Rogers and Mother Jones had a baby, Jim Hightower would be that rambunctious child, mad as hell, with a sense of humor. Jim Hightower is coming from Texas to the Bay with Susan DeMarco, his co-author, and their new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. They'll be in San Francisco on Wednesday, March 26th, at Horace Mann Middle School, at 3351 23rd Street. to benefit Global Exchange. The next day, Thursday, March 27th, they'll be in Berkeley at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing at Dana, to benefit KPFA. Both venues have wheelchair access. For each event, tickets are $12 in advance.